Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. One of the features of South African life, or certainly our body politic, is the way issues can sometimes sort of flare up and then seem to wither on the vine and go away. I don't mean big ticket stuff like corruption or racism or identity politics, but a good example of what I mean started a month or two back when the banker Colin Coleman wrote a piece for the Sunday Times, or more accurately, the Sunday Times published an edited version of a presentation he had made to an investment dialogue hosted by the newspaper. South Africa, he suggested, didn't have a debt problem. It had a growth problem, he said. But he added there was a solution. SA had the wind at its back. The commodities boom was not a brief windfall for the fiscus. It had at least 5 years in it. It was, he said, quote, a secular long-term response to refitting and re-engineering the global economy for climate change. What we needed now, argued Coleman, and led by an 800 rand a month grant for the unemployed, which would cost 115 billion rand a year, was a stimulus package that would see money plowed back into the economy and lead to a virtuous cycle of spending and growth. He was savaged in the papers the following week, but bounced back the following week, this time with a seriously famous economist in tow, Nouriel Roubini, who predicted the financial crisis in 2007-2008 in tow. Old-style austerity, they wrote, with structural reforms alone, will fail to kickstart the economy. They reproduced the same idea then as before, reforms and stimulus. But the problem, though, seems to me to be that our debt really is very high. It costs us 1,000 million rand a day, 1 billion rand just to repay the interest. Is it really austerity to simply try and get that under control? One of the people who criticized Coleman is also one of my favorite economists, Thabi Leoka. I strongly disagree with Colin Coleman, she wrote in between the two Coleman appearances in the Sunday Times. Contrary to Coleman's speech to the dialogue, she said, SA is in a fiscal crisis. We have 4 trillion rand in debt. Thabi Leoka joins me now. And thanks for two things, Thabi. First, for joining me. And second, for putting your hand up when you did. And for starting the argument that you did, because I think it brought a whole lot of clarity to a lot of people wondering where we are in the world and where our economy is in the general scheme of things at the moment. Why did you feel so strongly that Coleman was being irresponsible? What's wrong with a little stimulus?
Thanks, Peter. I felt that, Coleman was misrepresenting facts. There was a lot of information that was not correct in his first piece. And I needed to correct that, and not just for me as an economist, but I think the broader public. Sunday Times is a well-read publication. I also, Colin is an architect who worked for Goldman Sachs and became the MD of Goldman Sachs. So as an economist, I felt that I needed to put the facts out there and to highlight our enormous debt that is crowding out investment in areas that are more, could be more productive, and grow the economy and also help employ more people.
Are we able to measure the effect of stimulus if there is any? I mean, we do give a lot of grants to people at the moment. There's, welfare to the elderly, single mothers. Do the amounts they get show up in the macroeconomic data as positives for the economy?
They do to an extent, but employment would do so a lot more. So South Africa's fiscal policy and over the years has been very redistributive, and more so than any other emerging market of our size and also our emerging market peers. And we see taxes going towards helping the poor and vulnerable. We also saw recently the windfall that came from mining. A portion of that went towards helping the poor and vulnerable by extending the 350, that is the COVID grant that was announced initially last year. But the impact or the pass-through from a 350 versus a salary, and including the skills that one would get from working, are far higher than someone who just receives 350. The other thing that we've noticed, and I've tried to warn against, is that the people who benefit really out of this 350 tend to be retailers. And that's because of the structure of our economy. So retailers recently, I think it was Pick and Pay that said that it's extending 200 boxes into the townships. And that to me, you know, raised alarm because you are crowding out again small businesses that are based in the townships. And this is a big company that is doing that. And so those who are recipients of social grants and also recipients of the 350 Rand grant consume not locally supporting a local entrepreneur. What they do is that they consume to support an already established monopoly. And what happens is that the share price of these entities go off the roof as a result of that. And are they employing as much as they are growing? No, they're not. So the rich are buying stocks. And you saw yesterday that the JSE performed exceptionally well. And the poor are propping up these stocks and supporting the wealthy. And so that's the other part of where you have this 350 and where you have an economy that is not really equal and has been allowed to be unequal in many ways.
I wanted to ask quickly about austerity and the meaning of it and to ask you whether we are actually in a period of austerity, because it has a certain definition. It's the left in South Africa fling it around with gay abandon in order to make the points that they need to make. But are we in a period of austerity now?
So austerity refers to very strict economic policies that a government imposes to control, growing public debt. We have not yet had very strict or severe economic policies. What government did in 2012 was put a spending ceiling. And the idea was that with each year, the spending ceiling would be reduced. And what has happened over the years is that actually there's been a breach of the spending ceiling. And the spending ceiling was not just to cut and put, you know, policies that were restrictive. What it was actually meant to do, they cut a lot on infrastructure development in the hope that the private sector would then step in. And the private sector did not step in because the private sector is also worried about the future of the economy, the future of the country. Are they taking a risk in investing in a country that is very, in terms of politics? And there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of policies. There's a lot of uncertainty.
Does austerity work, and where have we seen it work recently?
So austerity has its pros and cons. A recent set of austerity measures that we saw were in Portugal and Greece. And the irony is that South Africa's debt servicing costs are three times higher than those of Greece when Greece was forced to adopt austerity measures by the EU. And what it did in Greece was that it was actually it helped the Greece economy recover. It corrected a lot of the issues that had to do with taxes and the bad utilization of the fiscus there. So they were overspending. There was a lot of corruption. There was a lot of undertaxing, and austerity measures corrected that. And as a result, the Greece's economy has grown into a better structured economy than pre-austerity measures. But having said that, if you look at Portugal, it was very too strict for Portugal. It actually slowed growth, and it caused all sorts of negative implications on its economy. And so there you have to loosen. They then had to loosen some of the policies to make it easier for, correction, economic and fiscal correction to happen in Portugal. So it depends on what measures you put. It depends on the extent of the measure, because it can be too punitive to the extent that it actually slows growth and becomes very disruptive. And you can have austerity measures that are supportive of growth.
I mean, you were very emphatic in your Sunday Times piece back in October, where you say not all deficits are bad, but when the nominal cost of borrowing is higher than the growth in GDP, a country has no business borrowing money. Now, the Greeks never got to that position.
No, they didn't. And that's because, I guess, with them, this is supported by the fact that they're part of the EU. So their debt servicing costs were, and then they had the austerity measures, which then helped reduce them. Whereas our case, we are a small and open economy. We don't have an EU, so that helps with monetary policy. We have our own monetary and fiscal policies. We have investors that invest in and out of South Africa, and they can put money and pull money out without any restrictions. And they then demand a higher premium for the for investing in South Africa or for buying our debt. And so that's what increases this our interest on our debt, because of the investors then demanding higher cover for the debt that they the exposure that they have on South African debt. And so that exposure and that increase in that risk was not seen in Greece in the same way as we're seeing this risk premium in South Africa.
And that's what makes our debt so expensive, much more expensive than theirs.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I presume that the risks on us have not subsided yet. I mean, we've had quite a year. We've had the violence in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng in July. Our politics are, interesting, if not, they're not unstable. It's interesting, though, we remain a viable and real democracy. It's not as if we are an outlying, a kind of a democratic outlier in the world, or we're a generally well-behaved country. It's interesting to try to think of oneself or one's country as being a little bit beyond the pale, I suppose, for ordinary commercial purposes. What is required for us to get back to the point where people who we borrow money from don't require such a premium on whatever risk that they think they measure when they look at South Africa? What does the government have to do if not austerity?
So, Peter, what happened after the MTBPS is that the 10-year yield started strengthening. And that is just an indication of exactly what you're asking. What do investors want? They liked that speech. They liked the fact that the minister mentioned that we cannot afford to just extend social grants without having to consider the money that we have as a country. So we need to be cautious. So they liked that he was very... He was very cautious of how we spend money. They liked the fact that he didn't look at, let's say, certain things like the commodity boom, and he didn't see it as something that will be there in perpetuity, and therefore we're going to get this windfall in perpetuity, and we can then fund social grants in perpetuity. So they liked that. They liked that he also mentioned that Treasury is not the only decision maker. It's government, of which Treasury is a part of. So they also liked that. So I think as a measure, what the speech was something that investors liked, and they showed it by what we saw in the yield curve, basically meaning that investors were buying into our bonds and were basically giving us a tick of approval for all the signs, the right words and the right signals that the minister had made in his speech.
My semi-expert question is the yield on the bonds and that they were buying, was that falling or rising after he made his speech the other day?
So falling, which means that there was stronger.
Which means that,
yes.
Okay. No, yeah. Okay. So I get that. I understand that he didn't cut anything, because the cuts had already been made. The social spending cuts, what were made, had already been made by his predecessor, Tito Mboweni. But beyond sort of holding the line, as it were, he's still got a lot of social spending to do. I mean, there's a lot of welfare that gets paid out in South Africa. Was he right, do you think, to discount or not take into account the possible effects of a long-term commodity boom? In other words, something that it could last, I think Colin Coleman was arguing in his first article, that it could last up to 5 years. Why not take advantage of that sort of opportunity if it's in your lap?
So that's a big risk because we don't know how long the commodity price is going to last. And you know, even if you ask the miners, they don't know. There's a bit of stockpiling. There's a bit of a reaction to, you know, correcting after or where we're normalizing. As we're normalizing, there's a bit of correction post or in reaction to the pandemic, the impact on the commodity prices that, and also stockpiling that the pandemic had on many of, let's say, even industry. We saw that vehicle sales internationally had slumped and vehicle production had slumped. And for we know there's been a greater demand because now there's production is normalizing in Europe and Asia, et cetera, in the US in terms of, you know, vehicle production, which is what, let's say, if you look at PGMs, what it's predominantly used for. So we don't know how long it'll last. And what typically happens is that when the US starts hiking rates, it has a negative effect on commodity prices. And so what we're seeing also is that inflation is increasing in the US faster and in the developed world faster than we expected. So if, let's say, the US then cuts rates, then, you know, commodity prices will be impacted. So there's so many moving parts to that you cannot then base your assumption on something that you yourself don't understand and you don't have a great details in terms of how long this commodity price boom will be. I would, for instance, use that money as an investment. I would take it and then put it in areas that would generate growth and also help the economy recover versus making a long-term promise to South Africans who are vulnerable, who need assistance to say, look, we can help you for a very long time because we've got this commodity price that is happening right now. So the risks are very high. And I don't think that, you know, any minister, especially the Minister of Finance, would make that commitment not knowing how long the commodity boom will last.
If you were, you said that if you would take that money and put it into something that would help grow the economy, what does that look like? What would help now? Because we've had so many promises from the government about infrastructure being built and, you know, ports are now going to be sort of semi-privatized. I mean, what are the things that, you know, give me an example of something that would, that you just know 100% would work if we spent money on it?
So something that firstly I'll mention that you don't need money on because the private sector will cover the cost of the spectrum. All that the government needs to do is that ensure that spectrum, especially the currently available spectrum, is allocated to those companies that can utilize it efficiently and utilize it now. And it's a no-brainer what spectrum can do because it just enables business. It makes business efficient. It reduces the cost of labor. So it puts more sense into people's pockets, especially those who are poor and vulnerable, who rely on communication using data, which is very expensive. They can also conduct business. So this whole migration into urban areas to look for business when you have a skill which you have in your hands to create stuff. You could simply do it from your village and use the internet and to then market yourself, and anyone anywhere else in the world can purchase. So it's a very easy way of conducting business and changing the economy. It also enables industry. A lot of industry is looking at digitalization currently, and they can't do it as quickly enough because of insufficient connectivity. So that's one. The other one is that we know there's a huge backlog in transportation. Our transport infrastructure needs huge capital to then take it back into or take it to invest in transportation, rail transportation, freight transportation, and not just our ports, but just our entire rail network needs huge investments.
Why? Because you're close to parts of government as well, you know, in parts of your portfolio life. Why is this not happening? Why is everything so painfully slow? You know, I mean, it can't all be COVID. Building a railway line shouldn't necessarily be stopped by a virus. You're outside, it's healthy, nobody's, you know, I don't understand why things don't happen, why they can be promised but don't happen. And the more we don't meet promises, the more promises we make. We're now going to build a smart city on the wild coast between Port St. John's and Port Edward. I mean, it's insane.
It absolutely is. I think that I have a suspicion that there's a capacity issue all, you know, across government, that there are ideas which are easy to make. Policies are easy to make because there are ideas that come up in your head and you put it on a document and it looks and sounds feasible until you actually have to implement. And implementation needs brains. It needs engineers. It needs technical people to actually put the bricks and mortar. So I think that that's where the problem lies. The other thing is that there are, I think government is also bogged down by regulation and also, so look at Spectrum. Spectrum is, the, you know, companies are ready, but they are going, it's an up and down between the regulator and companies in terms of who should be getting it, how, whatever. In any other country, this decision is so easy. There's a need. There are people who can do it. Give it to them. And then in the second round, make some money, tax them, whatever it is, but it's so easy to do. Rail infrastructure, there's a need. We all know that we need trains. We need at least the railway to be fixed. Companies need to transport their goods. But at the same time, there's just this dilly-dallying in government. Who's going to do it? How do we do it? Who's going to be in charge of the rail infrastructure? Give it to a company who can do it. At this point in our country, it doesn't really matter whether the person is white or black or colored or Indian. You know, give that person the ability to do so because it's so short-sighted to look at whether the service delivery would be what color a certain service delivery. I think for me, the measure should be who are the recipients of this.
Yeah.
And what does it do to change their lives and the lives of the and also the country, so that the country can develop. And when a country develops and grows, it can employ more people. But right now, the debate is about who are we giving it to, how, what composition are they? Are they wealthy? They're too wealthy. They're white.
It's very depressing.
Yeah.
I wanted just to ask you before. So, you know, the debate that you joined or actually started in the newspaper simply by answering Colin Coleman is so familiar in South Africa. It's a debate between left and right, good and bad, a populist or realist. Do we just live with that forever? I mean, is that the way life is in every country? I suppose there are different points of view. Is this going to be an endless argument, or is there an exit from it, you know, so that we can move ahead and do something?
I hope it's not an endless argument. And I do not argue for left or right. It is a problem. We need to solve it. That's how I look at things, very pragmatically. So for me, with the budget, I realize that there are a lot of poor people in South Africa. I also know that many of us have been giving more than your 350s into the thousands to poor family to help them out. I also know that those of us who've been doing that over the years, they haven't improved the livelihoods of those people that they have been helping, simply because to sustain it, these people need jobs and skills. Money is just not for sustenance. Jobs and skills are something that are even good for a person's mental health. And I see it within my own family too, that a person who has a job, even if that job is equivalent to the money that some of us have been giving, their livelihoods change, their attitudes change. And that's what I want for South Africans. I don't want South Africans to be receiving 350 in perpetuity. I want a long-term solution for South Africans, one that empowers them, one that gives them a salary, one that gives them a skill. And then once you have the skill and the salary, then you can also decide years later to venture on your own and start your own company.
Can you get a skill you can't get a skill without having a job for a start. And you can't have a job without an employer. We seem to have run out of employers, and yet we are very, very resistant to immigration in this country.
Well, you know, it is very interesting because if you travel around the world, you'll see Greeks, and I think the second largest population of Greeks are in Australia. And you go to the US and you encounter all sorts of accents and people from different places. And this is what makes the world dynamic. South Africa is interesting in that it is against people who travel, who leave the country for whatever reason. I think that we should, as much as people leave, we should also attract, we should also empower, you know, local talent. So I also think that you're right, that we need companies to start employing. But if you speak to a lot of companies, they want to grow. They want to employ more people. I often say to companies, especially those that are doing really well, that you think you're really doing well with an economy that is where 44.4% of the population is unemployed and doesn't really have money. Imagine if that number went down to 15%, and how many consumers a company would have, how much money a company would make as a result of that. So companies do want to actually grow, do want to employ, do want to train. But many times this endeavor of theirs is blocked by restrictions in government, regulations. They can't train certain people because only government can train. And this you hear from a lot of in the medical sector, where there's training of nurses cannot be done by anyone but the government. So government needs to also loosen up. They need to decentralize. They definitely need to loosen up their regulation in order for companies to do well and employ.
But when you're the leader of society, how do you let go of it? You know, to let it... to let it find its own way. That's all we have time for, and I'm so grateful to my guest Thabi Leoka for joining us and educating certainly me. I'll be back next week with another interesting and challenging guest, and hope to see you then. Bye bye.